Hello, everybody. I didn't realize when I came here that we'd all be asked to explain our access credentials, but I'm glad that I brought this t-shirt with me. Anybody at Access 96? Okay, now I have one of the very few black t-shirts from Access 96, because in fact I was the convener of that session, so just the people who organized it got the black one, so you probably have a white one. Anyway. So, and that was back in the days when I was a systems librarian before I moved over to be one of those administrators that Dale was talking about this morning. So now my job is to try and make sure that there's enough funding put into our systems groups. So, but I should. It has a few holes in it, though. I don't think you'd want to see it. So the reason we switched the sessions was that we thought that this one followed very nicely on the last session about user-generated content and the kind of research that we've been doing. And I get to start things off, I hope. So basically, I'm just going to try and convince you that this is worth listening to and tell you a little bit about why Queen's University got involved with working with BibliaCommons and make some observations that we've seen from our user studies so far about how people actually do conduct research and some of the intriguing ideas that we thought BibliaCommons was putting forward, and that's why we started working with them. And I'll turn it over to Steve, and he'll do some talk about the user research that BibliaCommons has been doing with Queen's on user-generated content and share some thoughts about the kinds of issues we were talking about in the last session around motivation that people have for contributing and quality of content that they might contribute. And then we'll talk a little bit about where things stand with BibliaCommons at Queen's. So first of all, what we're talking about here is discovery. And like many libraries, Queen's was interested in thinking about a new discovery layer. And the way that BibliaCommons defines that word discovery is really getting answers to questions that you don't know how to ask. And our catalogs have been pretty good tools at finding known items, but not so good at that discovery end of things. And the other definition that we like at Queen's is finding gems that you don't know exist. So when we were talking about what we were searching for in our next generation catalog, our web development librarian, Wendy, who's over there, was saying that it's a shame that we have really this huge treasure chest of jewels and gems that people don't know exist. And what we have as the front door to that is this sort of, you know, creaky door with cobwebs covering it, and it looks more like a haunted house than a castle of gems. So we wanted to make that better. And, of course, we didn't want to just put the lipstick on the pig. We wanted to actually fundamentally change things. The other thing that was on our mind was the work that we'd been doing with federated search tools. And nobody is ever very satisfied with the results that we get from that or that aggregation. And we really think of it as basically this big information blob that people get back. And that made me think about the movie The Blob. Anybody seen the 1958 movie with Steve McQueen? Your favorite movie. Okay, so I had to go find an image, you know, of the blob, and went to the Internet Movie Database to pick this image up, and then discovered by looking at the recommendations, a very social software sort of thing to do, that there's a remake of it actually in the 80s. So that center image is another version of the blob. And then from that recommendation, I discovered that really this problem is basically about information technology. That. And I don't know if that clown resembles anybody in this room, but the people responsible for it all. Okay, so thinking about really what our catalogs have done for us, we've been very individual in how we've approached searching in the catalogs. It's a solitary experience. You throw in some keywords and hope that you're getting back something useful, when in fact, learning and research are completely social activities. People are always sharing information with each other. That's what we expect students to do. That's what we expect faculty to do with their students. So here what we're talking about in terms of social is really that idea of considering the judgments and insights of others. And that brings us to user-generated content, and we've been thinking about that really in two senses, the sort of more narrow sense of tags and ratings and reviews, but also a broader sense about curation, and that's the idea that there are people who are culling information out there, trying to deal with that information blob, and that really we should put that that work into the space of those users who really don't know how to ask the question for the answer they want. So looking at existing implementations of user-generated content in that narrow sense, you all know about these. There's lots of them out there, and we heard this afternoon about one of them, MTags. What we were interested in thinking about is how this works in the academic environment. So the kinds of questions that were raised about, you know, will somebody sabotage things? You know, how are people actually going to be using these tools? So that was one of the things that we wanted to explore at Queen's with BiblioCommons. Looking at user-generated content in that broader sense, one of the most obvious senses of this is the citation index that you've all used. And this actually, when I looked at this slide, it made me go off and look at some research that you've probably all heard about. I think John Evans was the name of the sociologist this summer who published an article in Science about how the number of citations that people are citing is actually narrowing. And there's been some controversy about whether that's accurate or maybe the nature of the research. But what was interesting to me is when I went to look at that article, it led me off into this whole research about social influence. So, and that seems to relate to this topic. So I recommend you go and look at that article and follow some of those links. Of course, the reading list has been one of the most obvious kind of user-generated content. Students often start their research at this point, and this reading list is from Wikipedia, so that's one of the more accessible, obvious pieces of user-generated content that people rely on. And in libraries, we try to take it to another level of providing a path into those kind of reading lists. So one example of that is from the Dewey Library at MIT, the Dewey Research Advisor, which is a database of frequently asked questions. One of the intriguing things, I think, about this is the level of granularity here. We're often working at the level of broad subject guides, but what this does is put right in the path of the user this kind of very narrow question that they want answers to. So we were intrigued with thinking, well, how can we put that into the catalog or into the space that people are most frequently using? And then, of course, the ultimate research advisor is the faculty member. And when we were looking for our next generation catalog, our systems librarian, Liz Fox, wrote a little scenario about a student looking for information on Alan Turing. And BiblioCommons looked at that and thought of things in the network level and went and found this homepage, this prof who's at Indiana, I think. And he has this page. He's also written an article about how he teaches this course. And in that article, he makes a lot of commentary about the kinds of readings that he gave the students and when they found them useful and that kind of thing. So we thought, wouldn't it be great if we could capture that intellectual work that that professor is doing here in this course page in this space and somehow bring that into the catalog space? So that's the background on what we're thinking of in terms of user-generated content and that sort of broad sense of things. I wanted to tell you just a little bit about what we think we've learned about how scholars do research now. And there's a study that the Ontario Council of University Libraries did in this May. Basically, it was trying to help with the whole development of our scholars portal, which you may have heard about. And we contracted with Usability Matters to do this work, and they ran a number of collaborative design sessions with people across all disciplines. And one of the things we were having them validate was a framework that comes from the University of Minnesota Libraries. I don't know if you've all seen this, but it's a study well worth looking at. One of the ideas was that there are some basic functions that are common across all disciplines. And we tested that out with the people that we were talking to and did validate that. And one of the striking things about it, though, was that people added another notion to this notion of interaction and collaboration. And they said that's not a separate phase. That's something that really runs through the whole research process. And then we talked to them about a variety of things, but what came out of this notion of what happens in the typical research process is a lot of social activity. So, you know, thinking of keywords, they want to brainstorm with colleagues, they're looking at important works and seeing how that relates to their topic. We asked them to brainstorm about what they would like to see in the research process. They're talking about what others have searched for, the most accessed resources, those citation index kind of things we talked about. And seeing recommendations from authorities. Now, they weren't very clear about who they considered to be those authorities, but that's certainly something they had in their mind. But they also wanted ways to find surprises. So, you know, they want that serendipity that we all think is very important. So one of the things that struck us about this research is this word social. And often people are thinking in terms of social networking tools like Facebook. But in this group of researchers, few of them had even heard of Delicious. So they're not thinking in terms of social tools. But everybody had heard of Facebook, but they certainly didn't associate that with their research. So when we're talking about social, you know, it has to be in that sort of serious sense of social, I think, and not the fun social. So this notion of social discovery rather than social networking is something that came out of another study that we did at Queen's as well, which was really a study meant to inform the development about our website as a whole. But one of the things that we did in it was to explore what sort of social networking features we should build into our site. Now, the interesting thing about that research was that it felt like a bit of an add-on. So the students are telling us about how they work in our catalog, and then we ask them, what sort of social networking features would you like? So when you ask them about ratings and reviews, we had some of those doubtful comments, like we heard earlier, about how it could be abused. That, in fact, one student said, well, I think that people will mislead me because, you know, they don't want me to find the useful resources that they have. And also concern that that really the opinions that you want are from the faculty, but in fact, faculty have very little time and probably aren't going to be willing to invest that time to contribute. Same thing with reading lists. They thought that it was idealistic that people would actually contribute their reading lists. Now, this is one thing that BiblioCommons picked up on, is the notion that, in fact, though, students do want to connect with each other, and that they do that even when they're in the library. They'd like to find out where their fellow students are and be able to collaborate on that level. So one of the themes that came through with all this was, even though they were telling us that they didn't think the kinds of things that they were doing in that fun environment of Facebook really applied to their research, they did tell us that they really wanted to know what their trusted colleagues thought, the professors and fellow researchers. So that we did that study about, a year and a half ago, I guess, and then when we were looking for the next generation catalog, we had BiblioCommons present to us, and we had those things about tags and reviews and ratings in mind as the social aspect of things. But listening to that broader sense of what we think of as user-generated content seemed very intriguing to us. So we began working with BiblioCommons, and Steve is going to tell you about the user research that they started to do with us in the academic environment. So I'll turn it over to Steve.
Okay, so the BiblioCommons product is three products in one. It's an OPAC, it's a next generation catalog, and it's a social discovery system. And although this topic of this talk is on the social discovery system aspects, we really wanted to ground our user research, and most of the planning and the design and development that we've been doing is really on the OPAC side and the next generation catalog side. So in March of this year, went over to Queen's, recruited through faculty through email, others through a link on the website, and had one-on-ones with the sessions, as well as focus groups with the librarians to talk about how do you do your research, really kind of foundational type things. Some findings. So the non-librarians don't limit or don't use facets all that much. You'll hear a presentation later on from ViewFind. We showed different examples of other next-generation catalogs. The ViewFind one was actually the facets were used more so there. Our hypothesis is that not so much that it's on the right, but the background colors, it seemed to integrate more into the page. This shouldn't be new. I think Amanda presented last year of lack of use of facets, and NC State has as well. Also, in terms of reformulating queries, students didn't do that. You use the back button and you type over, start again completely. You're not ORing and that kind of thing. Librarians, on the other hand, do want, you know, we can't take away their command line syntax with their Boolean commands and wildcards and blah, blah, blah. Students would take a look at LCSH and avoid them like the plague. There wouldn't really be much you could do to get them to want to click on that. Although that if it was presented in a different light through a virtual shelf browsing tool, that did test well. Librarians argue that the value and the curation and the intellectual bibliographic control through the subject headings is one of the primary value adds. When you ask a student and to confirm their process that they're actually taking to write a paper, it takes them 4 hours to manually kind of put things into APA citation format and copy and paste and re-edit. It's not a point of pain. They don't mind it. It's just part of what you do. It's part of the ritual of completing your paper. One of the requirements from librarians was we must have direct export to RefWorks. So a little bit of a different answer. Again, a lack of trust of or a lack of a strong sense of independence of I don't want to ask a librarian for help. And librarians are there to help. So this is just kind of give you a sense of the types of things that we found. There's as you can see, a little bit of tension between the extremes, but we are hopefully designing for users in the faculty, student, staff sense, rather than the librarians. So what I'm going to talk to you now is the second round of research that we did in June, and that round was completely devoted to the topic of user-generated content. Put up an ad, pay-per-click ad on Facebook, and got about a 0.06 click-through rate, which is about average for a Facebook ad. Went ahead and got them lined up for one-hour sessions the next week, had them in at the BibliCommons office in Toronto, and sat them down to take a look at a few different things. And you can see the range of mostly U of T students, but a little bit of diversity. So I'll show you as we go through kind of the different, we went from computer screen to a paper thing to a complete mock-up fiction. I used a bunch of different things, including a screenshot of MTagger. And the focus really on this round was Martha's made a really strong distinction between user-generated content in the narrow sense, tagging, ratings, reviews, and user-generated content in the broader sense of curation and really kind of, depending on the judgments and insights in others through a thing like a syllabus or a reading list. The focus of this round of research really was more on the narrow sense than the broad for a couple different reasons. And one is that our existing application at Oakville and other public libraries really has strong support for the curated lists already. There may be some things that we need to do in terms of research and development for optimizing the flows for maybe there might be a faculty syllabus tool that would output to, a course reading, a reserve list, as well as, a bookstore course pack and putting items on order at the bookstore and outputting out to the courseware as well. That might be, a feature that we have, or figuring out really how to optimize the flow to convert an ad hoc reference transaction, where you're giving a patron a list of three sources, and how do you convert that oral or email exchange into a list that could be integrated with the catalog. There's things that we can tweak, but in general, we already had a design of how to do the curated lists, and it works pretty well. The second thing was that it's still pretty early days. There was all those logos up there, and we heard a great presentation about Michigan's experience, but there's not really consensus or understanding of which data elements are important, and why would you tag? What are the motivations for contributing content? Nothing that I know of. I was in touch with Suzanne at Michigan and told me about the work that they had been doing with their interns there. But I haven't seen really kind of all that much research of really kind of identifying what works and what doesn't in terms of ratings, tags, reviews in the academic library catalog. The good thing is that the concepts and the motivations work equally well between the narrow and the broad. So I think we're in good shape there. Okay, so the first thing that we had them do is we sat them down and we asked them, when you want to buy a camera or when you're looking for information about a movie, where do you go? What do you do? So really grounding them in, when you're doing research and research about products, what types of tools do you use? If they started out talking about non-web things, we might shift the conversation into web things. And from there, we would say, okay, well, do you ever look at, comments by others and that kind of thing, if they hadn't volunteered that already? Most of this crowd in this 18 to 22 age range volunteered that they sought out sites that had user-generated content. And they said that they actually prefer people like them, comments from the ordinary Joe, than seeking out critical reviews. The New York Times movie critic or the New Yorker movie critic wasn't useful to them. It didn't speak to them. They trusted their peers more so than the professionals. The large majority had used Rate My Professors, which shouldn't be any surprise. But in terms of making product choices, making selections, and using gathering information to make decisions, looking at the insights and the judgments of others is part and parcel of what they do. So if you talk to them about catalog, and then say, oh, how would you like to use Facebook? You might get a different answer than, okay, well, how do you go about your research process? And what factors are important to you? In their use of Rate My Professors, they looked a little bit at the numeric ratings and whatever, but most of them skipped down into the comments and really kind of looked at the individual comments. They might be looking at different things. Okay, is there consensus here? Is there something speaks to me? Like for a restaurant, I'm interested in the ambiance and I'm not so much interested in the price, something that jumps out, looking for outliers, but really kind of gravitated to the open-ended free text comments rather than the numerics. And some said, I don't trust numerics, I don't look at them at all. But even in just kind of looking at their eyes or where they moved on the page, they're immediately scanning to the open-ended comments. And I think this one summed it up really well. That's where this generation is at. Better for better or for worse. They want people like them. There is a healthy distrust about the professional paid editorial opinion. Okay, so we actually did go, and this wasn't planned at all, happened to be looking at pen tags and mTagger, and the example that I picked, I went to school at Michigan, I just picked mTagger, and we took them to a bib record, and this is after we've kind of talked and kind of oriented them through, okay, moving from product research, let's talk about library research and school research, show me your library homepage, tell me about where you go, whatever, got them through to the catalog and took them to a different catalog. Below on the bib record, we showed them this, and we said, what is this? Now, in Ken's talk, Ken slipped over the slide that said, what is a tag? We all know what tagging is. Well, we all know what tagging is. But what we found was 2 out of 10 participants had any clue. And the reason they had any clue was because they tagged on Last.fm, or they had tagged on their personal blog. But when we showed them this, they had absolutely no idea. I had, it's the types of guesses that they had ranged from some sort of, Yahoo Buzz or dig style voting, or they wanted to offer comments on it or to give a rating. They actually had no idea what was going on. And so we librarians know, this is a graduate who's just entering the program at U of T. She had absolutely no idea. We asked again, have you ever heard of tagging? No, absolutely not. Okay, Facebook, have you ever tagged on Facebook? Oh yeah, tagging Facebook. Absolutely no connection. And this wasn't just an isolated example. I'd say at least half of the people had tagged in Facebook, immediately recognized that label of tagging. Oh yeah, you visually crop, the picture and you identify the name. Okay, so this says tagging here. What do you think? Oh, it's like a completely different planet. Really, really interesting. Playing with other labels and the, what is a tag text? We no one even seemed to look at it or notice it. So ideas here, one, maybe possibly changing it. This kind of, we're all hip and sassy librarians and Web 2.0 and whatever. Everyone knows tagging. I think it's important to realize that that we really can't skip over that, and really need to design for where our users are. So one option is to change the labeling. Talk about kind of, you know, keyword description or themes, or, you know, what terms would you use to help people find this? Looking at different kind of labeling options. Another thing that I think would be useful would be to show rather than tell, you know, the what is a tag link with the what is a tag text. If there's some way to convey the value immediately, you might get more participation. So a couple interesting findings there. Okay, so then we moved on to kind of completely hypothetical wireframes. Okay, a couple of different scenarios. This is happened to have the Queen's masthead. But let's take a look at what are the types of data elements that would be useful to you. So this product feature in the BiblioCommons product is recently returned. Well, we actually write, most ILS systems don't have a table for recently returned. If you do consent and give permission to track that, we will actually write information to ILS system and track. And on login, give you the opportunity to see what you've recently returned. That's a great opportunity to really comment on it. So on the body of the page, here's what I've recently returned, a slider type thing of how helpful was it to you, which course did it apply to, and then a bunch of different options. Okay, well, did you use it for a paper? What was the paper name? Did you reference the whole part of the book or just specific sections? How familiar were you with this topic before you borrowed the item? Just trying to, you know, we didn't really kind of walk through each and every detail, and we're you know, consistent about, you know, statistical significance of the publishing the research. But we want to get a sense, okay, when you look at this, does any of this speak to you? And the upshot was, because I think this comes in later. So let me keep going ahead. So another kind of completely hypothetical example. Okay, what about in the course reading list concept? If you're looking at a syllabus online and you saw the opportunity to somehow get to a pane that would ask you, okay, how relevant was this to you? What was the level of difficulty of the reading? Was it of personal interest to you? What about length and skimmability? Just kind of taking guesses of what are the types of things, what are the data elements that would really that you would want to find that other people have tagged or contributed for you. And these, I don't know if you can tell by the diagram, but we kind of explain, okay, this is like a slider thing. You can put your mouse and, you know, this is good and this is bad, and kind of talk them through that. So the answer, so in the course context, the most important data elements are, you know, is it going to be on the test? You know, so, you know, there was a lot of that, but there were some nuances, and there were people who said, you know, specifically interested in learning and really, you know, it wasn't about them to know. It was relevance to course of things like, you know, is this reading related to other readings, or, you know, how tied is this reading to the lecture? You know, so really trying to get a sense, you know, those kinds of things, you know, when, you know, you're at the library late at night and you haven't started the reading yet, you know, how do we embed that type of conversation, you know, into the catalog and to the discovery experience? Second most further down was clarity or level. It was framed as level of difficulty, but we ended up with kind of clarity. And that was also strong. At the most, people said, you know, okay, look, I could definitely see filling out one or two data elements. This whole screen with all the sliders and whatever. The sliders make it easy, you know, to rate things quickly, but, you know, giving me a list of 10 different elements isn't going to be that motivating to me. The having indicators on the slider, of which we didn't have in the mock-ups, of having, you know, knowing what's a 5 and what's a 7 and that kind of thing is helpful. A lot of people really did want to be anonymous, so the ability to choose a username that isn't personally identifiable it would be a good thing, and may make contributions more likely in some cases. Other people didn't care. You know, I'll give you my social security number or the Canadian equivalent of whatever that is. And most people did want other students to see their comments, really, really open to sharing. They really, really saw that as a value. The person who, when we showed the first mock-up to her, I mean, her reaction was, you know, why would I do that? You know, in the end, you know, she said, Okay, yeah. If I'm anonymous, and it's only a handful of things, sure. You know, I'm willing to do that. Okay, so a third mock-up that didn't come as high because it involved interacting with librarians. This is kind of an ask a question interface, similar to the MIT Dewey Research Advisor. But you know, for a particular question, where can I find historical and current economic data for countries worldwide? Again, a very finely granular question, a real world question, a reference question that people are asking, not a subject guide about economics. You know, kind of turning that ad hoc reference interview into something that's visible, and giving, here are the four suggested sources of where to find the answer to that question, and then rating, okay, how helpful was that source to you, and what are your comments on that? Because people are so resistant to ask for help, there weren't a lot of people kind of, you know, running up and down to contribute, but, you know, if other people had done that and it was integrated in a way in the catalog experience, you know, as an explore further, you know, here's a book on, you know, historical economic data, you know, worldwide, you know, suggested sources kind of displaying in the catalog experience. Sure, that makes sense. Moving away from these more kind of graphical mock-ups into kind of a paper mock-up, looking at a course hub context. So talking through, okay, imagine you log into the library. You know, the mechanics of authentication mechanisms and the details, you know, didn't worry about that. But just kind of, hey, here's a list of your courses, and what if you could see, you know, a link to the syllabus? You know, when you logged into the library website and it would show you where the syllabus is for your course, that was gold. I mean, that was money. That was, you know, like, I would love that. You know, that's absolutely fantastic. That would be amazing. And I think there's a real opportunity there. You know, it's people use at Queens, it's WebCT, you know, there's some use of that, but there's also homegrown websites and this and that and the other, and you can't find it. Having the library be the first place to look, you know, to gather these disparate sources, well, my syllabus is here, and the course reserves list is here, and the bookstore course pack is over here. But just kind of unifying that was something that was of value. Okay, in terms of when would you be most likely to contribute, a couple different findings here. The course reading context seemed like the best place to go. So if you are online and you're looking at the syllabus online, giving feedback on week one's readings when you're looking at week two's readings seemed like a great way to go. Obviously, that's fallible. You know, you've got a paper copy of the syllabus and, you know, that kind of thing going on. So it's not fail safe, but seemed like a great way to go. On the recently returned, we've got that in place now. In terms of an email notification, I mean, my ideal way to go is that when you drop a book back off on the library, there should be a screen right there that says, you know, hi, Steve, or hi, you know, my BiblioCommons username, you know, can you take a few moments to give you feedback on this book that you just returned? Pie in the sky, absolutely, but that's the best opportunity. Or if you're, you know, submitting your paper and to turn it in or to the professor online, what if there's a way that we can extract, you know, and you've got permissions to take your identity and there's a shared single sign-on and all those minor details. But take the citation list and say, okay, when you're turning in the paper, can you give feedback? You know, which of these sources were most helpful? Which of these weren't? You know, that's the sweet spot. So figuring out kind of the mechanics of that, still a little bit hazy. The email notification, some people said they didn't mind. Other people don't want to be bombarded. You know, so let's say I returned the book yesterday. You know, would I want an email the next day saying, look, can you give me your feedback on this? Some people yes, some people no. We need to figure out how to approach that carefully. The answers mock-up was a dud. They don't want to ask for help. And even, you know, the fiercely independent ones won't go to the TA even. I mean, there's the perception that, okay, well a librarian is someone who shelves the books and who checks out the books for me. And if I ask them, even though they may be the economics librarian, if I ask them a question about economics, they're a librarian. They're not an expert in searching on economics. They don't perceive librarians in that way. So, well, what if we said, you know, contact an economics expert searcher? Oh, okay, good. Well, what if we told you that that the librarians had an advanced degree, you know, in a master's or certification in that field? Oh, yeah, you know, maybe. So playing with the labeling, you know, not calling ourselves librarians, you may get more satisfaction and more use of your services. Okay, so next mock-up, piece of paper, handed off the piece of paper to them and said, look, okay, we've talked about different ways to contribute. There's people might contribute for a lot of different reasons. You might be motivated by cold, hard cash. You might be motivated by a desire to give back to your university that you're paying tens of thousands of dollars a year to. So giving a list of different types of things, earning credits, an opportunity to have my voice be heard, giving back, getting recommendations, helping others. If I, you know, quid pro quo type thing, just a bunch of things. And we said, okay, go ahead and check off, you know, which ones are most motivating, which ones are least motivating. Tell us when you're done. Let's talk about it. So the answers were the cold hard cash, and actually the number one motivation wasn't the cold hard cash. It really was what they said. Now, what they do later on after we've built the system, we've got actual numbers and whatever, may be different. But what they said was the strongest motivation was getting to useful resources faster, helping others, helping us be more helpful to you. Those were the types of things that were more motivating. Within that, a strong sense of this idea of paying it forward. If I do it now, it'll help others later. You know, if others do it, it'll help me when I need it. Also, this concept of an empty restaurant syndrome. You know, if there weren't a lot of tags there already, why should I be the first one, you know, to visit that restaurant to contribute tags? If they saw other people jumping in a lake, then they would want to jump in that lake as well. And second was that, you know, this idea of credits that we have in the BiblioCommons system. There's every time you contribute a tag or a comment or whatever, you get a point. And we work with the libraries, the customers, to figure out how do you cash in this point. So the idea of cashing in for printer points or fee, you know, reduction on fines or something seemed to be more prevalent than the idea to win, you know, an iPod or a vacation trip or something like that. We'll have to figure out, you know, with Queens kind of how to make that happen in their context. The idea of giving back to my school, you know, that I've paid, you know, tens of thousands of dollars for, or even giving back to the library. They might use the library every day, but definitely not as strong in the academic sphere as it has been for us in the public sphere. Okay, barriers to contributing. Don't like freeloaders. Like being able to freeload themselves. Okay, put that together. Do you see the connection? Yeah, I see that connection. You know, how do you make that connection in a tight label, in a user interface? Need to play with that a little bit, you know, but that idea of, okay, I don't want to help people that are just looking how to skip to the readings that are going to be on the test. But I want to have that when it's available to me. They understood that concept and they recognized that in order to get, you needed to give. Another thing that was really interesting was that I got the sense of no matter how many times someone would tell them that they wouldn't be accused of plagiarism, there was still this perception of fear that they would be. So in the types of conversations asking, okay, well, let's say you submitted your paper into the professor and to turn it in or whatever, would you want, you know, to be able to have not your paper, but your reading list, you know, available, okay, on this topic, using these themes and keywords? These are the sources that I cited. Some people yes, some people no, but pretty much across the board, I could get expelled, you know, like really someone has drilled into their brain that any type of talking about any type of, you know, kind of content that really you could be accused of cheating. So I think that in order to succeed, you really need either the librarian in the classroom or the faculty, each and every faculty that's, it's got their official blessing. No, it's okay to share. It's okay to talk about the readings. It's okay, you know, to work together. That's the way that we learn. That's the way that we research. Okay, so that kind of rounds out kind of the findings from the user research. Wanted to spend a little bit of time of talking about what we're thinking now, strategies for ensuring quality contributions and not getting the kind of unhelpful or lower quality type contributions. Three categories of strategies. First is that patron authentication. You know, so the idea that you're actually logging into the library, even though you can create a fictitious persona, your own username, the idea that it's the library, you know, that you're more serious, you know, you're more likely to put more thought into your contributions. That's a faith assumption that we have. It's something that that we need to test. Second type of strategy is aggregation. Not being able to, you know, avoid kind of drawing conclusions based on one individual comment. When you start, Roy's Birds of a Feather, which sounds really interesting, is when you're able to pool content from multiple customers or multiple systems between BiblioCommons and SOPAC or WorldCat.org or whatever, you're able to see more reviews from different sources. So you get, you know, you're able to kind of filter on that. And then also kind of being able to click on the username. For us, that's really important that you want to see kind of all the reviews. So you can say, ah, Steve, oh, he's off the deep edge. All his reviews are wacko. You know, I will ignore him. So being able to see more helps you be able to refine. The third kind of key idea is really kind of designing a marketplace of ideas. So this idea of a librarian moderating tags to publish them sounds a little bit scary, but just not technically scalable. You know, when you're talking about the volume, there's got to be a way to design a system so that it's self-managing. Whether you're automatically doing sentiment analysis of positive sentiment versus negative sentiment, or having, you know, the Amazon type reviewing the reviews, I think, you know, that's moving into kind of, well, here's an average number, which on the Rate My Professors, you weren't interested in the average number. You're not average. You are a beautiful, you know, unique flower, you know, and, you know, these three other flowers, just like you, you know, the three students in your class found this reading helpful, you know, or the four faculty included this item in your course reading list. Being able to provide kind of rich user profiles and to leverage those profiles. Privacy, yeah. Interesting. I think librarians, I agree with Eric, you know, it's librarians are more worried about it than users are. But being able to, rather than just, okay, if this record has a review, then bump it up, you know, boost it in the relevancy ranking, that's not helpful to anyone. But really being able to foster connections, you know, to other users in your trusted network seems like a good idea. Okay, so the vision, where do we want to go? And this is kind of near-term, middle-term, long-term. Near-term, we want to provide a smart catalog that's got a great user experience. So these are some of the types of examples of details of, you know, why on every OPAC do you have a list of 43 different buttons at the bottom that's, you know, report a typo in this record and, you know, put make a recall and all the different types of request actions. Can't we be a little bit smarter about presenting up, you know, the context? Look, if it's checked out, then place a hold on it. You know, if it's on the shelf and you can't place a hold, I mean, just having kind of the conditional contextual display, those types of details that we're really kind of making sure that we want to get right to have an overall kind of great experience. So that's near term. Midterm, want to move into a direction where we're really organizing the catalog experience around the course and around the assignment. You're not going to click on the LCSH subject headings. If you trick them and you don't, and you make them not look like the LCSH, if you show a visual cover flow type display or whatever, maybe more palatable, but where we want to go is being able to, you know, pull the information from the registrar. If you give consent, we'll link your account. You'll be able to log in. We see that you're registered for these six courses. When you want to tag something, we can auto-suggest, okay, tag it appropriate to one of these six courses that you're taking right now. So taking steps to really encourage that kind of course level, assignment level contributions, and exposing that in the interface so that when you log into the library, you see a course-centric or an assignment-centric view rather than an amorphous blob of LCSH subject headings or something. And the third, which is further down the road, is really kind of breaking down the barriers between data silos. So the library website is one silo, the Xero Solutions A to Z list, and the courseware, and the article databases, they're separate things. Not a big believer in federated searching. I think ideally having that centrally, whether it's at the network level at an OCLC or at the network level at a BiblioCommons or through kind of a synced up interface like SOPAC, it could be good. But having the power to really kind of take down those walls is a direction that BiblioCommons in Queens wants to go in. So where are we at in terms of reaching that vision? We've done a fair number of user research, both in the foundational stuff on the OPAC Next Generation Catalog. We've done this smaller research on the user-generated content, and that's really driving our design process. We've got, because of all the... someone this morning mentioned something about the inner cataloger in all of us. I have gotten quite familiar with the inner cataloger inside of me, and so kind of mapping at mark fields and subfields, and how does it map, and how does it index, and how does it display, and kind of working through that in the academic context has been a whole lot of fun. So through this year and next year, we will be an iterative beta release process, and so that's where we are headed. With that, I think we've reached the end, and happy to take any questions that you have. Yes, sir.